Yeah. One of the topics that you kind of start out the book with is this problem of evil and Bible mm-hmm. contradictions as well. Do you find it odd that skeptics like Ehrman and kind of tend to focus on this subject? It seems like such a far reach. Or, you know, are people still banking on this kind of, according to them, kind of antiquated idea of, you know, there's evil in the world, but we just kind of call it whatever we don't mm-hmm. like. It seems like a weird thing for him to focus on, for him being kind of so scholarly in yeah. his other yeah. subjects.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of interesting even deciding which chapters to include in the book and which topics to address and even in which order. In the end, that was not our initial plan, but in the end, we decided to front it with the problem of evil and then why does God allow suffering? Because even though it's a little more advanced topic and it's really more complex than some of the other issues we're dealing with, it seemed like that was really the foundational issue, at least for him. And in my experience, also for quite a few other people that I would sometimes be asked to speak on this topic at university campuses. And I usually ask my host, you know, so I can't talk about probably everything in the book, you know, what do you want me to talk about? And I would say the vast majority of times they want me to talk about the problem of suffering.
Is that right? Wow.
And, you know, to your question, I do find it odd, you know, I don't want to get off track by talking too much about Bart Ehrman, but his field of expertise is text criticism. Right. That's what his first book was on. You know, the Orthodox Corruption of Scripture. He studied with the renowned text critic Bruce Metzger at Princeton. And yet in many of his writings, he makes it sound like his main problem is related to the text of the Bible. You know, the text of the Bible is corrupt. There's contradictions, which is more a field of harmonization or even biblical theology. But then it's very clear in his book on suffering that his real problem is with God allowing human suffering. Mm-hmm. And so it almost makes some of his other work, like Jesus Interrupted and so forth, disingenuous looking, because, you know, there he talks about things that by his own admission are not even really the reason why ultimately he rejects the God of the Bible as an agnostic. And, you know, as far as I know, he has little formal expertise in that area, because that's a matter of, you know, theology, a matter of philosophy. Mm-hmm. And as far as I know, he's a rank amateur in those fields. I mean, he's even honestly a rank amateur in biblical theology when he talks about, you know, alleged contradictions in scripture. He's really out of his depth, as far as I'm concerned, as a trained text critic. You know, I do feel like it'd be wise for him to read up, honestly, on some of those fields at the very least. When you look at his footnotes, they're often very sparse. And I remember looking at the Jesus Interrupted book, very few footnotes, and I think almost half of them are to his own work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which shows you how kind of self-referential he is and feels that I know something about, you know, he would not even show any awareness of the existence of some key works, like in this case, Richard Bauckham's Jesus and the Eyewitnesses.
Right.
You know, he yeah. doesn't refer to that book a single time in Jesus Interrupted, when obviously, you know, that's a key contribution in the field. So that's not very scholarly.
Yeah, it does seem like him replying to specific claims rather than kind of the general knowledge claims of oh, well, we know John wrote John. Well, you know, can you talk about that? Can you talk about Papias and the like? It seems sparse there. And to your point, I think going through your book and seeing how many times he does play this kind of theologian of like, okay, so God, we know that the Bible's not written, you know, by God's inspiration because, you know, there's these 400,000 changes or whatever number we're up to. But it seems like then you have to assume something about a God that you don't believe in, that you don't think that that we've misconstrued, that we've had a false sense of who Jesus is or what he's saying or what could possibly be said. And it seems like you're going along as John and you're writing, in the beginning and you mess up the word beginning and it's almost God has to take your hand and erase it and say, no, that's not what I said. Come on, come with me.
Yeah, and again, I mean, those of us, right, who have tried to witness to, unbeliever, I mean, part of what you try to find out is what the real issue is, that they're struggling with. And then let's talk about that, not about some, smokescreen that even if I give you an answer, it's still not going to ultimately change your mind. Right. And I think in his case, I feel like, in those debates, he's debating Dan Wallace, for example, on text critical issues, when all the while his real problem is over here. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes it can be frustrating because I think people don't realize in those debates, there's actually debate rules. And so they're imposed on you. You can't just talk about certain things because you're not supposed to. And so if the debate is supposed to be a text criticism, you got to stick to text criticism, which is one reason why I would usually not agree to those kinds of debates, because I need to be free like a laser to focus in on what I think the key issue is.
Yeah. I think back to one of my favorite debates with him is the one with James White, and I'm partial to James White. So that helps too. The main topic is what in any of the New Testament documents do you see a change that would result in a change of theology or claim? Yeah. And he points to a passage in Hebrews that Dr. White walks through, and it's just, well, there's no issue here. And, he tries to hang his hat like that. That's your biggest thing is this one change in Hebrews. And of course I'll link to the debate again that we talked about in going over your book as well. And it seems like, even in his interviews, he'll on one hand talk in the book of the 400,000 changes but he won't codify that when he goes to an interview and says, oh, well, what do you think the Bible really said back then? And he's like, well, pretty much just says what it says now. And then kind of towards your other end of the chapter, Jesus never existed. And he'll even say, well, of course he existed. Where do we go to? The text of the New Testament is the best source. So, which is it?
Well, and sometimes there's two audiences. I think he's generally more careful when he knows he's talking to other scholars because he knows enough about, what scholarship says. And so he can't be too simplistic. But most of the time, he has a much easier day when he talks to, a popular audience. And there, he sometimes makes very unguarded, really irresponsible claims that, I think deep down inside, he needs to know that he really can't defend those claims, or he would never get away with it in a scholarly debate, but then again, the millions of people who have, bought his book, whether or not they read them all, sometimes they're unsuspecting victims. I mean, you just think about really preying on freshman students at UNC Chapel Hill, who are not religion majors, right? They're an easy target. It's almost unfair to think about, right? That how unequally they're matched with somebody like this who knows just exactly which buttons to push to get a certain reaction. It's very, I think, dangerous. And he's a false teacher. And so I think as a result, I feel like as a father, as a, even apart from scholarship now, a responsibility to protect unsuspecting, teenagers who enroll in his classes and who have no idea that he has a kind of this agenda to basically challenge their faith to the point of basically destroying their faith. And it's not fair and balanced. In our book, we talk about the fact that he doesn't always give you the other side, just hear his side of a story. And so part of our effort in our book was to give people the other side of a story so they can actually make up their mind. that's not integrity, right? If you deliberately withhold what you know to be powerful counter arguments to view, or you just give people very selectively, you know, what supports your case.